Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. When we think about ag tech, at least here at AgThentic, we aren't just thinking about the technologies themselves. We're thinking about new business models in agriculture, and of course, we're thinking about the innovators that are driving changes along the value chain. Today's guest, Fiona Aveyard, is definitely an innovator and an entrepreneur, as well as a farmer. Though Fiona does use technology and make lots of data-driven decisions on her farm, what we talk about today is how she's working on a new supply chain and new value-add products that can bring more profit to her farm and can bring benefits to her regional community. And we talk about how Fiona is doing all of this while facing the worst drought in history and what that's like. This episode is again part of our series in partnership with Farmers to Founders. Farmers to Founders is an innovation program designed specifically for primary producers. Fiona is one of the businesses in the program. Applications are open now at farmerstofounders.com for the Ideas program. So if you're a producer with an invention that you think could be commercialized or an idea for a new product, check out the Ideas program. It provides support, coaching, funding, and a community of other innovative and entrepreneurial producers. So with that, here's Fiona. She starts by giving us a rundown of her property.
So we are mixed farm, what I would call a traditional mixed farming operation in central New South Wales. We're about an hour southwest of Dubbo. Our nearest small town is called Tullamore. We're about 25 k's from there. So there's me, my husband Bill, and we've got four children. We live on a farm that joins the farm I grew up on, and we would be fifth generation farmers in the area. So even the farm that we live on is a soldier settlers block that was cleaved off the original holdings that my ancestors had, 130 years ago. But after the Second World War, I think they broke a lot of the properties up to give the returned soldiers blocks, which worked really well in the small communities for a long time. But as farming changed and mechanisation and expansion and all that sort of stuff, a lot of the smaller properties were eaten up by the adjoining ones. And so that's how Bill and I had the opportunity to buy here. And so it's 1,500 acres at West Point where we live. We own the next door place, which is Warrenilla, in partnership with my sister. I've got another block that is on the other side of Aurora Park, which is my dad's place, called Robbo's, which we bought a few years ago. And then my husband has his block up at Trundle, which is part of his family succession. He's got two other brothers and they've got block country there as well.
And all mixed farming across all those different properties?
Yep. So we have merinos for the wool production. We usually run around 1,000 merino ewes, and we've got crossbred ewes. We usually run between 1,000 and 2,000. It sort of depends on the seasons and how much cropping we're doing and that sort of thing. And then we do mixed cereal cropping. So wheat, barley, canola, chickpeas, oats, all that sort of stuff. Cut our own hay, store grain on farm for the dry periods and do all that sort of thing. Bill's brother has a merino stud. My sister breeds camp drafting horses, and my dad breeds standardbred horses. But yeah, generally it's the sheep and cattle, and we haven't got any cows at the moment. We normally have Angus cattle, but they've been long gone in this dry period.
Fiona, like many farmers in Australia, has been experiencing some seriously extreme weather. Though the floods, drought, and fires have been in the news locally and globally, it's really hard to get a sense of what's actually happening, what it's like for the farmers and for the regional communities they live in, without seeing it yourself. When I spoke with Fiona, the east coast of Australia had just gotten some much-needed rain. West Point, Fiona's farm, did get some as well, but it came with another challenge.
We did. We got under jagged a very narrow storm the other day. We had 20 mils. That was before the massive dust storm. I don't know if you've seen it all over social media today. It stretched, honestly, from the northwest to the southwest. It was the biggest dust storm I've ever seen.
It looks like a movie. Like it looks like when they go to like a different planet in a movie and they're like, oh, this planet is a desert planet with dust storms. Like, no, that's just Australia.
Yeah, that's just central New South Wales. So that's exactly what it was like. And it came in, like normally you get a lot of wind and there's a bit of a build up before it gets a bit stormy and all that. But this was so, there was no wind. Like it moved really quickly and it was a quiet and very eerie. Like it was very, just a bit unsettling, to be honest.
It looked like a mountain. It was totally crazy. So that impacted you guys then directly? Like does the dust come over your property and what impact, if any, does that have?
It's more like it's the house, like it's, and it covers everything with this fine red dust that is, it doesn't matter. Well, our house is an old farm cottage anyway, so it's not dustproof at the best of times, but this is the sort of dirt that permeates like a sealed chamber. Like it just, it covers everything in your house, the walls, this everything with this layer of dust that you just, like it's so hard to show. To move. So that's what's disheartening. It doesn't really do anything per se. I mean, apart from obviously the obvious, which is blow your topsoil away and all that sort of thing. But we'd had some rain and, you know, things were a bit more grounded here. That's obviously coming from out west. But it's just more the, and it gets dark. Like it's like in the footage that you see of the bushfires, like literally it just blocks out the sun for the 10 or 15 minutes that it's going past.
Oh my gosh, that is terrifying. It literally is a movie, but not a movie.
It's just a sad, sad real life.
As if the dust storm wasn't enough, Fiona is still battling the drought.
We ran out of farm water on the farm that where my sister lives that joins us about 6 months ago, and our house ran dry this week. So we've moved all our livestock up to another property at Trundle where there's better water, and we've got a couple of hundred deer that we're just carting water for. So it's like one step in front of the other. Like it's a grind, actually. Oh my gosh. It'll have to end soon.
You say that so casually, like, oh yeah, and then we're just out of water. And it's like, what? I'm sorry. That's a massive deal. I actually did want to ask you about that, if you're okay with it, just a little bit about kind of some color for people who maybe haven't been in regional Australia during the drought or don't actually know kind of what it's like, because I think you talk about it in a way that's really honest and would love to share a little bit of that if you're up for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's it's the hardest thing to explain, like it's because it is a grind. Like it's just one foot in front of the other day after day. You're doing the same thing and you know that the seasons will change, but then as you get closer to, like last year is a good example, as we got closer to that autumn break and we didn't get an early autumn break, but there was some forecast of some weather, so we're pretty optimistic. There were a couple of cyclones up in the north and that usually feeds in down here pretty well, and that's certainly what all the forecasts were saying. So there's an anticipation and excitement that comes with farming because it's an exciting time to be planting your crops or, you know, joining your sheep and all that sort of stuff. And it's a bit like we've got horses as well. I always say it's like when you pick a stallion for your mare and or the foal's born, and it's always the derby winner. Like it's the excitement of the possibilities. So you do get excited, even though, as it turned out, we didn't get that early autumn break, we didn't get a mid-autumn break, and we didn't get a late autumn break. We've got no rain all year. So that's really hard. And as you get those trigger points for in your plans of where you're going to be, if you're going to do stock or how you're going to manage, you know, do you buy more feed, and you're doing those sort of budgeting and talking to your bank managers and trying to figure out exactly how you're going to do things. And as those trigger points get closer, you get more and more anxious because you're like, if there's a forecast rain event, you know, you've got a date on the 1st of September or something, there's a forecast rain event for the middle of September, you're like, do I hang on another 2 weeks or do I stick to my plan? Like, it's just anxiety inducing. You can't second guess it. It's awful, to be honest. I can't say it any other way. It's awful.
It sounds like the up and down of it is just exhausting too, the kind of constant hope and then not hope and then hope again and then not hope, that in any context is exhausting, and in one so important as this seems overwhelming.
Yeah, that's it. And it's gone on for years, which is really, that's the grind, I guess, in terms of it does get you down. I mean, people are well aware of mental health issues, and particularly in farming, because there is, you know, a high incidence of people suffering or having suffered, you know, taking their lives and that sort of thing with mental health. But there's not that many of us, so people really keep an eye out on each other and reach out all the time. Like, and most of us have been here for such a long time. We do, like, we're optimists in that we know it will rain again. Like, we've all been in droughts. We've never been in a drought like this, and there is the added reality, I guess, of climate change, and is this what farming is going to be, and how are we going to deal with that, and what's the legacy we're leaving for the next generation? That is, again, another burden of how you're approaching your job and what changes we have to make now for it to take effect to benefit the next generation. So there's a lot of things that people have to consider that are very, you know, nobody's got the answers, I guess. You just have to really believe in what you believe and pin your ears back and hope for the best.
Yeah. Oh, I want to go back to something you said before, Fiona, about trigger points. Is that a kind of concept, like conceptual trigger points, or is it actually more of a set of management decisions you guys would set up in advance?
Yeah, so that's exactly what it is. So if when there's grass in the paddocks, like what point you're going to move sheep on, when there's like no rain and you're getting to a point where you want to join stock, what are you actually going to join, and what's not going to be productive for you for the next 12 months going forward? So do you sell them? Do you, you know, how do you market them? All that sort of stuff. Do they go into a fat market? Are they fat enough to go into a fat market? Are you looking to a restocker? All that sort of thing. So, and the trigger points for most of us where we're not on irrigation, like we are, usually around a date. Like it'll be, if we haven't had rain by the end of the autumn, then what are we going to do for the winter? Right, we're going to carry this many stock, we've got this much feed, how are we going to manage that, and, you know, what are we going to look after, and all that sort of thing.
The coverage of the drought in the news talks a lot about the impact to regional communities. Speaking with Fiona helped me to understand what that really looks like, the cash flow challenges that individual businesses are facing, and the flow-on effects to other businesses and to the community as a whole.
The hardest thing is when it's your cash flow. So when you're basing your decisions around rain events, and you might have a budget for a certain time, or, you know, you'll have commitments in terms of maybe fertilizer or stock feed or shearing or, you know, stuff, outgoings that you can't not pay. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, the shearers ring, they're coming 2 weeks earlier, you've just got a load of feed, the money's not in for your wool because it didn't reach what you wanted at sale, so you held off because you didn't think you needed it for another month. And it's those cash flow kind of components that are very tricky, and it just makes you, that's what puts people under enormous pressure, because then they don't want to go out, because it's not that they can't pay their bills, they're just slow paying them, because the money in these economies, when you're in regional areas, everything slows down. So if you're slow paying your fuel, then they're slow paying their bill. Like, it just flows on, and that's when people isolate themselves, which is the real danger. So it's in terms of your mental health and that type of thing. So it's hard to stay on top of everything all the time when there's so many variables, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And with the, the joke I've been seeing around Twitter recently is like, how can any of these weather people or tech companies predicting the weather keep their jobs, because they just keep being so wrong?
we all know it's hard, like, and particularly in the summer, like, but we're not, it's unlikely we're going to get general rain in the summer. It's all going to be storm events, because that's traditionally what happens. It doesn't, you know, climate change or no climate change, you get your good general rain in the autumn and the winter time. We, you know, pray for a spring break to get crops through. And if you're lucky enough to jag something in the summertime, then you'll grow a few catheads and some Bathurst burrs, you know.
Despite the truly catastrophic challenges that farmers like Fiona are facing right now, it's situations like these that can also really help to bring people together.
I think we're all seeing it with the fires as well, so that probably people will understand so much more. But we do farm tours on the farm, and the number of people that have come out in the holidays to do a farm tour, and because they follow us on social media and they know it's really dry and they want to come and spend some time in the country, that type of thing. And so that's really, and they bring, you know, the rule is usually, like when we were growing up, if people came to visit you, they always stopped in town and got some fresh milk and the daily newspaper, because they're the sort of things you don't get on the farm. And the people that come out here, you know, they'll grab some fresh fruit and veg and, you know, just pop out and do a farm tour and hang out, have lunch with us. And it's the fact that they care is what, you know, sort of catches in your throat. It makes you really just a better person, really, because then, you know, hopefully we can pay it forward one day and everything will go around nicely.
Seeing the challenges in her local community and thinking about the future is actually what inspired Fiona to look at a new business model for their farm.
We were looking at our local community, Tullamore, which is really struggling to stay afloat, really. You know, it's always to have a little shop or all that sort of stuff. It's just a battle for everybody to, the population isn't really here to sustain it. We used to be a three-teacher primary school, and then they had to drop down to a two-teacher, and we're just thinking about that and just going, gosh, I wonder what the future is, and it's a pity we don't have any industry and all that sort of thing. And part of it is that as farms, you know, through the factory farming era and the age of mechanisation and all that sort of thing, we've all expanded, we've all got bigger equipment, we've all bought out our neighbours as they've, you know, moved on and that type of thing. So we're all running pretty big properties, but then in terms of the community, there's less people, that you don't have the workmen, people are having less kids probably. I mean, we have four, but most people would have two or three. And it just, you reach a point in the community where you wonder if it's sustainable, and it's like, well, we can't keep buying properties and getting bigger and bigger because we can't do the work. And as time goes on, you miss the old quality of life. You know, everyone always says about living in regional areas, oh, it's the lifestyle, we love the lifestyle. But when you're working 7 days a week and really long hours, you're going, well, the lifestyle kind of sucks at the moment. So we were just sort of thinking about how that was going and what it would look like for the next generation. We had a bit of a family meeting, and my husband had just gone through their family succession, which worked really well, and it's held up to be a great example where the boys had always known what they were getting. He has a sister who's off farm, and she'd always known what she was getting, and it worked brilliantly. Nobody fell out and everything was good, but each of the boys have gone on to lease or purchase additional country, and I'm like, is it the great answer? Because what, you know, where do we want to live, and what do we want to live in the next 20 or 30 years, or, you know, what are our children going to live in? And I just thought, well, maybe we should do more of a value add to the country and or to what we're producing, and create jobs within the farm, like vertically rather than horizontally, so that if the kids want to have work on the farm when they're older, we don't have to buy another property and, you know, borrow all that money and do that sort of thing. Maybe we've got the opportunity within the farm already to create business and jobs, and that would have a benefit not just for our immediate family but for the community and at large.
When you were thinking about that, did you find yourself, were you like the crazy uncle that's like thinking totally differently, or was everyone kind of on board? Was it a thought you shared with anyone?
Yeah, no, Bill and I talked about it at length, and we, you know, were chewing over it for many, many evenings and car trips and, you know, what can we do? And I was like, well, I reckon with the lambs there's a great opportunity, you know, we could do a value add. And we've always, like, we do live in a bubble, and I say this all the time in regional areas. Like, I kind of had a feeling that people would be interested in the story, and that was part of us as well, of wanting to do Outback Lamb, was that farmers get such a bad rap from vegans and environmentalists and people who just think we're the worst environmental vandals and cruel to our animals and do all these terrible things. And most people love their animals and do, you know, would if there was an animal in distress and it was nearly dark, they wouldn't leave it. Like, they'd go out and catch it and bring it back in and treat it and do all the, they'd look after animals before they'd look after themselves. And yet the general public don't seem to recognize that or acknowledge it. And whenever there's, you know, something in the media, it's always about how we're mistreating the animals or cruel or doing, pushing down trees or doing all this sort of stuff. And was like, I really think that if people knew the story, that they would be so much more connected to the land and their food source, and just understand it a bit better and be a bit kinder about what they think. And we had a lot of backpackers coming through the place as well. So I was sort of telling the stories to them as they were coming through, and they were going, oh, but isn't organic much better? And I'm like, well, organic is much better, but sometimes organic, it just means that people have taken chemical out of the equation. It doesn't mean that they're addressing everything else. And I said, in the same way that a good farmer might be doing everything else really well, but some glyphosate at an opportune time might be a great solution, even though it's not something that they would use all the time, but they don't qualify as organic, even though the food might be more nutritious than its organic counterpart if it's not managed properly. And as they lived here and worked here for ages and really got to see how things were done, they developed a greater understanding, and it made us want to share that a bit more widely.
Hmm. And what was the first time where you like took a step? You were like, okay, I'm going to go from these concepts and this belief and passion to like branded lamb and sausage rolls. Like take us forward to when you actually decided to do something and what that was like.
Well, I think I Googled a lot of stuff and I was like, right, I'll do a business plan. That'll be a great idea. And anyway, I got about 3/4 of the way through the business plan and I was like, God, this kind of sucks. I think I'll just start it and see how it goes. And I had a meeting with a great fellow in Dubbo who has a business called Principal Focus, and they were so generous with their time. Bill and I went and saw them, and I just said, look, I'm thinking of starting this paddock to plate business. What do you think? Blah, blah, blah. And we sat down with them and had a massive 3-hour conversation, and they'd done a lot of research and talked us through a lot of things. And it was his suggestion. He said, well, whatever you do, don't call it West Point Lamb, with West Point being the farm name. And he said, because that means nothing to anybody. He said, call it something. And we developed Outback Lamb then as a company, because I didn't want it to just be something that we started and then it disappeared into consolidated revenue and nothing ever happened again. I thought if it had its own entity, then I'd be a little more driven and focused about getting it up and running.
One of the best pieces of advice that Fiona got when she was starting Outback Lamb was during a course that she took. The course was actually more about the farm business, but the instructor told her something that would prove quite pivotal for Fiona.
I remember him saying, you don't need a lot of capital to start up. And this word for me was a little bit of an epiphany, because I was thinking, oh God, I'd need, 10 or 15 grand to get a web page and blah, blah, blah. And after talking to the guys at Principal Focus, it was, we need like 10,000 hits before you even get one sale, and, looking at all those sort of stats. But then he said, oh, well, why don't you you can just start up, you can get a web page, you can do Wix or something like that, pay a monthly subscription, and it doesn't have to cost you the earth, you can build it yourself. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I thought about a bit of a logo, and I talked to a girlfriend I went to uni with, and I was like, rip something off the internet, and I was like, can you make this enough different that it can be mine? and we just kind of meandered along, I guess, basically, in terms of, right, I need a brand, right, I need a web page, okay. Then I went and spoke to a couple of butchers. There was an abattoir. So a lot of things happened opportunely. There was a micro abattoir opened up at Canoundra where we could get minimum kills done. Like, you didn't need a minimum, sorry. Like, you just get anything done. So that was a great starting point for us. It was quite expensive, but it was a great way to dip our toe in the market for doing the whole bodies. And they would do the butchering, box it all up, and then we could pick it up and get it delivered to the people that were buying it on the online store.
After getting stuck in and getting going, Fiona had a few tough decisions to make.
A lot of people asked us if we were going to do farmers markets and that type of thing, but we were very conscious early on that we didn't want to make another job for ourselves in just, have another. We really wanted to go into whole bodies and be more wholesale, but have our own brand attached to it, and that provenance that it was grown and bred here, and we can do all that kind of thing ourselves.
But of course, like any startup, getting Outback Lamb off the ground was not easy. Fiona had to challenge herself to learn new skills and to get out of her comfort zone.
I struggled a lot with social media in the early days. It's a bit hard to get over yourself early on, where you're just like, oh God, I sound like such a tool. and you just don't want to put things out there and you're a little bit embarrassed. But then I was talking to a friend and she's like, well, when do you ever look at somebody's post and go, oh, God, they're such a tool? Like, and I was like, well, I never actually, I never do. So that was, and you just, it's yesterday's news, you know, you put it up and it's, you know, you think, oh, God, I sound like an idiot. But anyway, and tomorrow I'll put something new up and it'll be gone. So I just practiced and just got into it and just, yeah, got over myself really.
That's it's so funny. Like it's just like any startup and all the same pitfalls. Like we should start with a business plan or we have to spend tens of thousands of dollars. Those are really common myths, whether you're a farmer starting a business or a tech person starting a business, and they're not true either way, which is always interesting to see those parallels.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely that. And then early on, we got a little bit of traction early on and it was going quite well. And I'd said to Bill, I think I might get like somebody in the, like a Marcoms kind of a person on board to really help out in terms of just tidying up the web page. And I was happy with it. It was good, but it wasn't great. You know, like it was my first effort. So you can imagine what it was like, but it was clear and I knew what I was saying, but I needed more, just a bit more spit and polish on everything. And so there was a lady in Dubbo that who'd been recommended to me, and she came on board for 3 months and she just like cracked the whip and really got me into gear in terms of getting a bit more of a plan with the social media. She got me doing the recipe blog and getting sort of the idea being to offer more than just, you know, this is our outback lamb, it's better than other lamb, I promise, to try and get people to give them more than just the lamb. So we were doing the recipe blogs fortnightly. I was doing a quarterly e-mag with just news and stories on the farm, and we were doing the social media kind of stuff and just trying to just connecting generally with the public and the people that were interested in what we were doing. And she was great. So that gave me a lot more focus and a bit more drive and definitely lifted our profile.
Building a strong social media profile helped Outback Lamb to get started and to attract some customers. It also led to other opportunities for Fiona, like being invited to participate in a business course.
Regional Platters in Dubbo, which is a combination of a few shire councils, but to promote the region as food producers. And they did like a business and social media course that went on for 3 months and we popped in every couple of weeks type thing. And the culmination of that was that we had to do a pitch and we had to have a project. So I collaborated with the gourmet goat lady at Colli and Farmer Brown's Pastured Eggs at Wellington. And we did a pitch to say that we really wanted to get a refrigerated truck so we could take our full body sheep and goats and the eggs into the Sydney markets. And we won that. So that was a $15,000 boost to the kitty. So then we proceeded to get a little refrigerator truck, which we drive now, and that has really helped to grow the business as well. So just the publicity we got from that, but also, you know, the cash and it let us get a really good quality truck.
There's like such a good theme there of the combination of like do it yourself and get started and that kind of hustle with like really strong partnerships and surrounding yourself with good people, because you did that both with the initial advice and with the help with the website and then with the partnerships there. Like it's such a, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, same with a startup, but also you have to put in the hard work yourself. And it sounds like you've done both.
Well, you kind of, as I said, it is hard because you're coming from a point of pretty much zero knowledge, but you can, you know, you can pretty much Google anything. That's what I've discovered. So you just find out. And if you can see a gap in your business or something's not quite right or whatever, then you can usually find somebody that is an expert in that area and you can or source out that information. And it's sometimes the hardest thing sometimes is spotting the gaps. Like, and that's where Farmers to Founders was quite good, because you, when you're working in that bubble and you're just moving forward all the time, sometimes you don't stop and think, oh, why did I choose that? Or why am I doing that? Like you don't give it enough thought. You're just progressing all the time. So Farmers to Founders for me was a great opportunity to sit back and look at the business from a bird's eye view and go, well, now why am I doing that? Why is that? What am I trying to get to? Like what, now that we've done this, what does that tell me? And how can I get to the next point and that type of thing. So that was a wonderful opportunity that I don't think you could do on your own.
One of the aspects of the Farmers to Founders Bootcamp program, especially for the teams doing value-add products like Fiona, is a focus on the macro trends that are driving today's consumers. Learning about these trends has inspired Fiona to make some changes to Outback Lamb.
Our business is whole body carcasses into Dubbo, Sydney and Wollongong. That's what we do. But in order to build on that brand, we try and have a presence at local events and festivals and that type of thing when the opportunity arises. So we did a Beers to the Bush festival in Dubbo last year, and I was thinking, you know, oh gosh, what could we have with a beer? I know, I'll do a lamb sausage roll. So we went to a local baker and I was like, look, if I bring the lamb, can we do like a gourmet sausage roll? And I think we did lamb, harissa and almond. And it was, you know, really, honestly, it was so easy. Like I dropped the lamb off, we mucked around with the recipe for half the morning and then we cooked them up and it was like, yeah, that's good. All right, I'll bring some more lamb next week and we'll have, you know, 500 for the festival. That'll be great. And that was literally how easy, how much effort we put into it. And they were a huge hit, so people really liked them. And when we did other festivals, there was Trundle Bush Tucker Day and there was a Jimmy Barnes concert at Tullamore. So we did the sausage rolls as well. We did other stuff. We did lamb koftas and I'm trying to think what else we've done. Anyway, all like different sort of foods, but the sausage rolls were always popular and people were asking for them outside of those events and, you know, can we put in an order and all that sort of thing. So when the Farmers to Founders came up, and part of what we want to do with the lamb is really, we'll maximise our return, I guess, is the focus, but it's about using all of the animal. So we were like, you know, we can do bone broth and we can do sausage rolls and, you know, how do we manage all of that type of thing? So we, just went with the sausage rolls. And to do that with, when we got to Farmers to Founders, they were like, well, you know, have you thought about doing something that's preservative free? And I was like, well, I haven't, no. And when we talked about all those mega trends and things that are happening in the world and what people are looking for and about that, you know, what would make somebody eat a sausage roll and that type of thing. Well, the preservative free really jumped out at me as something that we could do to differentiate what we're doing and connect with that sort of artisanal market and that paddock to plate sort of theme that we're already building on. And then the other thing was looking at the mega trends and it was more the snackability, like how when would people eat a sausage roll and all that sort of thing and what size do they have to be. And we were doing quite more massive, big, long sausage rolls for the festivals. And so we've fine-tuned that and made them a little bit smaller.
I love it. Snackable. It's such a big trend actually. And like everything is snackable now and it's like cute and bite size and you can have a little baby one and especially that are more indulgent, like something that's otherwise maybe seen as not something you eat every day, or it's a bit of a treat, or it's indulgent, like having a small one. It's like, oh, it doesn't count.
Well, my kids love them. They have them as afternoon tea when they come home and that's exactly. So I want them to have something, but not ruin their dinner, if that makes sense. So I was like, yeah, well, that definitely works for me. So we'll do something like that. And also that, you know, when do you eat sausage rolls? Well, they're always quite great at a party, you know, that 5 o'clock is having a beer and a sausage roll, or, you know, when people pop around for drinks on a Friday afternoon, that type of thing. So we're just really, yeah, it just made me try and think about how we might fit into that market and what people were interested in.
So with all these changes, what's up next for Fiona and for Outback Lamb? And what does the future hold?
Well, I guess in terms of our next plans, hopefully we'll launch the sausage rolls in the next month is what I'm really gearing towards now. And then and this is drought breaking and, you know, a whole heap of other provisos, but I'd dearly love to either develop a microbrewery on the farm or close by that we could utilise. I'd like to do it in a community like Parks or Dubbo, somewhere close to the Inland Railway line, because I think that there'll be a lot of other farmers that would like to do similar things, and to have access to a little micro abattoir would be a great asset to a small community. And in that way, we can really then own all of the animal. We can really try to find markets for the offal, and develop bone broths and do that type of thing, and really get to, a point where the whole animal is utilised really well. So it's the whole animal and how we can really maximise the return for it.
At first, I thought you said microbrewery.
I think I said microbrewery. I was like, oh, shit.
And then I was like, oh, this has really gone to left field.
Yeah. I think I did say microbrewery. It's clearly 5 o'clock, isn't it? No, microabattoir. That's what I meant to say.
Oh, my gosh. Too funny. I was like, well, I'm going to be your first customer, but not to the abattoir, just to the brewery.
Bill, my husband Bill loves beer, so he would be all over a brewery if we did. He's like, can you make beer from lamb?
Funny. Maybe last question, Fiona, what would you have any advice for another farmer who's thinking about maybe having a go with an idea and maybe is in that stage of feeling like too hard to get started or they're the crazy uncle with just an out there idea? What advice would you have?
I think that I would actually say just get in and do it. Like it's, you won't know unless you try. So it's, I just feel like agriculture is really changing, that the, you know, these eras of productivity and expansion and where in order to increase your profits, you increase your carrying capacity is and all that sort of stuff and you do pasture improvement. But I just feel like it, for us anyway, in this where we don't have irrigation and we're not marginal country at all, but we are marginal rainfall and it's really important that we're on the lighter end of stocking rates and all that sort of thing. And we've got to look after our soils and we've got to look after to have a future in agriculture of what we do. We need to be making better returns on what we're producing. We need to basically make more from less. And that's how agriculture has to change. And that's what we're trying to do here at Outback Lamb. And I think that surely it's not just us that think that. I think that other people would be seeing the same things. And, you know, the pressure you put your country under to try and make ends meet is just not, it's not a sustainable option. And we, you know, the opportunities that come from the regenerative ag push and how people are really looking at their soil health. And we're in a great position because we are mixed farming. So it's that benefit of grazing and producing meat, and it's just so, it works really well. And the cropping is obviously a big component of our income, but it's like, you know, living in a banana republic. If we keep mining our country and trying to put it back in term with artificial fertilizers and using chemicals and all that sort of stuff, then it will ultimately deplete. Like we can see that already. So we need to change what we're doing. And I always say to the kids, it's a bit like living off McDonald's. You can get the calories you need, but you don't get the nutrition. And that's the kind of farming that we're heading towards. So that's why we need to stop and rethink that and change. And that's what I'd say to other people is, you know, what sort of farm do you want to have and how can you change your business to meet that?
You can tell by the confidence in Fiona's voice that she's come a long way and that she really believes in what she's doing with Outback Lamb. It's not easy for any entrepreneur to keep this conviction, especially when you're starting a new business, and let alone during a drought when everything feels like an uphill battle. And Fiona says it's not always easy and she's not always confident, but that hasn't stopped her.
It's, as I said, like, honestly, I feel like I'm sure everyone's the same, but you mill around aimlessly and the fear of fraud or, you know, there's some special tool. You're like, oh, I'm really not the expert, but I'll tell you, you know, I can talk about what I can talk about because that's what I know, but wouldn't be so vain to think that I'm absolutely right, but it's the direction that we've chosen because I think that I can see there's a need for change. I don't know what the answers are, but this is, you know, we can't just keep doing what we're doing. We've got to change.
Yeah, so true and so hard to get started, but that's really all you can do, right? Is take that first step. So I'm just continue to be impressed and humbled by stories like yours and the tough times you're facing, but how positive and forward looking and innovative you are, because it's definitely not easy and it's really hard to understand from the outside. So yeah, just appreciate you sharing the story.
Oh, no, you guys have been amazing. It is honestly it gives you such a lift, like to apply for something like Farmers to Founders and then to be selected. You feel like you've won a little bit of lottery. Like it's like, oh, they really like what I'm doing, you know, like it gives you a lift because you just think, otherwise, you know, unless you're doing things like that, you're like, oh, I don't know. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but how are we, you know, is it? And it's a crazy time to be trying to value add to lambs, because the drought has meant that the lambs increase in value exponentially because of they're basically supply and demand. Like it's like I don't even know why I'm trying to value add, because I could just keep them an extra 2 weeks and add them to the and put them in the sale yards. But anyway, we've got a plan and we're sticking with it.
Yep. And yeah, like I said, I mean, you got to start somewhere, and it's, I mean, startups are like, you know, experimenting and trying new things, seeing what's working. So you're definitely on that journey.
Thank you.
Cool. Thanks so much, Fiona. Well, I will let you get to your beer in your new microbrewery.
In my microbrewery. Oh, my God.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Ag Tech, So What? You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.